Welcome to Obesity, a Disease, the official Obesity Medicine Association podcast exploring the many facets of the disease of obesity. In this episode, obesity medicine specialist and OMA clinical education director, Dr. Nicholas Pennings, interviews Dr. Ken Fujioka, a keynote speaker from Obesity Medicine 2020 Virtual, about disease treatment and obesity. Obesity, a Disease podcast is brought to you by the Obesity Medicine Association, the clinical leader in obesity medicine.
There's a clear connection between obesity and diabetes. Obesity, especially in younger individuals, greatly increases the risk of developing type 2 diabetes. Yet the focus of diabetes treatment has primarily been on glucose control, often with medications that promote further weight gain. The theme of the OMA virtual conference held in May 2020 was Treat Obesity First. There are numerous diseases that are either caused or exacerbated by obesity. Treating obesity in turn improves adiposity-related diseases, especially for type 2 diabetes. Hi, I'm Dr. Nick Pennings. I'm Chair of Family Medicine at the Campbell University School of Osteopathic Medicine and Executive Director of Clinical Education at the Obesity Medicine Association. And I have with me Ken Fujioka, MD. Dr. Fujioka is the Director of the Nutrition and Metabolic Research and Obesity Telemedicine at Scripps Clinic in the Department of Diabetes and Endocrine. He has completed over 150 clinical trials and authored over 100 peer review articles. In 1997, he started the Center for Weight Management at Scripps Clinic that has grown from one physician to over a dozen healthcare providers that covers all aspects of obesity treatment. He is proud to say he is certified in obesity medicine by the ABOM. Dr. Fujioka was a keynote speaker at the OMA 2020 virtual conference. His presentation was titled Management of Diabetes by Treating Obesity First. Welcome, Dr. Fujioka.
Pleasure to be here.
So let's get started with the basics. Why is it that obesity and type 2 diabetes are so closely related?
It's a combination of factors, but probably more than anything, genetics. So the genetics for type 2 diabetes and weight go together very commonly. And as many of you know, it's also the way you gain your weight. So you have this genetic propensity to gain weight centrally or viscerally. And then that's the fat that creates the insulin resistance that then leads to diabetes. So they're very interrelated. And again, I feel like I'm preaching to the choir. Everybody knows that the weight is what's driving the poor glucose control.
And then so how does weight loss impact type 2 diabetes?
So it hits from so many different good angles to help out type 2 diabetes. The first one is that fat cells themselves are just not good for diabetes. They create a lot of inflammatory factors. They are personally responsible for the insulin resistance that makes insulin not work so well. So just by decreasing the amount of fat in the fat cells, dramatically lowers the inflammatory factors, dramatically and lowers the insulin resistance, and the blood sugar just, not surprisingly, gets much, much better.
Is there a difference between different types of fat cells, say compare subcutaneous fat versus visceral fat in terms of its impact on diabetes?
Correct. A huge difference between these two cells. And hence why women tolerate fat cells so much better than men. They can gain their fat subcutaneously or, as we say, peripherally. So it's that layer that you can grab. Unfortunately, it's the layer that people like to liposuction. But it's really the visceral fat that's around the organs. And that's what's driving all of this. And it's just impressive because something as simple as, say, hypertension, it's now very well shown that it's the fat literally in and around the kidneys that's driving the hypertension. And again, that's the visceral inside central fat that's driving all this. And there are certain races that gain more central fat, say Asians, for example, really gain their fat centrally. If somebody is Caucasian or African-American, they tend to gain it initially peripherally, but after a while, they're going to gain it centrally as well. So they're going to get into these same problems that we're talking about.
And I think that sometimes creates a little bit of confusion when we look at BMI and risk of diabetes, that if your BMI is high because you've gained a lot of subcutaneous fat, you may not necessarily demonstrate metabolic dysfunction with conditions like diabetes versus patients that have not necessarily that as high a BMI, but more central adiposity, and then in turn had developed metabolic complications at a lower BMI than others.
Very correct. And that's why there's now, as you know, many guidelines saying, you know, really think about measuring waist. The waist will really tell you more about the visceral fat or the central fat as opposed to the peripheral. Very useful. And it's even gotten so specific that we now have different waist measurements for, say, Asians versus Caucasians. You know, the cutoff would be, say, about 40 inches for a male in the waist, but for a Asian male, you know, they cut it all the way down to under 37 inches, 36 and a half. So a much more accurate measure. But here's one, you know, little treasure or pearl that will help you out. If anybody has a BMI of 35 or higher, you don't even need to measure the waist. They have central adiposity.
Right. So that's more for the overweight and class one obesity that you would be concerned about that.
Exactly.
In the treatment of type 2 diabetes and through weight loss intervention, there's lots of different options and lots of different approaches that can be taken. And one that has been increasingly popular recently is intermittent fasting. And intermittent fasting can mean a lot of different things. It can include alternate day fasting, it can include time-restricted feeding. But what are your thoughts about the risks and the benefits of intermittent fasting for a patient with type 2 diabetes?
Very fair question, very good one, in the sense that if you had asked me about intermittent fasting, time-restricted eating, say 2.5, 3 years ago, I would have said, oh, that's the craziest thing I ever heard. But now I truly think it works very well. In other words, the data is very good that intermittent fasting or time-restricted eating really helps with type 2 diabetes from a couple of different angles. And the first thing I want to do is just make sure that we know the difference between time-restricted eating and intermittent fasting, because they really both try and accomplish the same thing. But what you're trying to do is you're trying to send a message to the human body to start burning fat and to shift into a protective mode where it knows it may not get calories for a while. So intermittent fasting is just where you'll pick 2, 3, 4 days a week where you eat 500 calories or less for that whole day. So that during that day, you go into this starvation mode, which we used to think was bad, which turns out is probably not a big deal. The other issue or the other thing you just talked about was the time restricted, which is what most of us do more commonly. So time restricted is where you'll have a patient say, start eating at noon and they'll go until 8, and then they'll not eat from say 8 p.m. until noon the next day. And they both are accomplishing the same thing. Time restricted, which I'm really going to focus this on, is the one that I'm more used to doing and have done some studies on. But in essence, what you're doing is you tell the body no calories. So you go about 12 hours, 15, 16 hours, and the body says, you know, I'm not getting any calories. I'm really going to have to burn fat because there's no carbohydrates around. You've used up all your carbohydrates. And you now force the body to run strictly off fat, which is a good thing. And again, an easy way to measure this, as again, you all well know, is that when you're burning purely fat, you start to release ketones. So it's a very good measure of it. And once you do that, you're doing two things. You're burning fat, so you're lowering your fat mass, and that then creates a lowering of inflammatory factors. It helps dramatically with glucose control, and it really helps insulin work much better. So it's, again, very useful in the patient who has diabetes and weight to deal with.
And so that improvement in insulin sensitivity, I think, is one of the things that is a great benefit and something we should all be striving for in kind of our strategy for treating patients with diabetes.
Correct. I mean, if you look at even the drug treatments, most of them improve insulin sensitivity. And so if you can just do that with diet, hey, why not?
And that seems to be a bit of a shift where the focus was more just about controlling the glucose and bringing down the glucose level versus improving insulin resistance.
Right. If you look at the old treatments, sulfonylureas being the most famous one, you know, that really drives up insulin level, but that doesn't really help out the insulin resistance. And as we talked about in the lecture that we gave at OMA, it was it's very clear that unfortunately sulfonylureas in the long run are probably not good for the type 2 diabetic because you see more cardiovascular events.
Right. That actually leads me to my next question. In recent years, there's been increasing attention on the impact of diabetes medications on cardiovascular outcomes. The FDA now requires new medications for diabetes to show that they do not increase cardiovascular risk. And some of the new medications for type 2 diabetes actually show a reduction in cardiovascular risk. So perhaps you can give us an assessment of the cardiovascular risk of agents currently available for the treatment of type 2 diabetes, and what role should that play in our selection of medications for type 2 diabetes?
So looking at the spectrum, and we'll just start off with, you know, what everybody considers as the first line treatment, metformin, that's a very good medication. And if anything, has data showing that you're not going to have worsening of cardiovascular events, if anything, lowering. And as many of you know, even in a pre-diabetic, it will slow down the progression to diabetes. Why? Because it's working on the insulin resistance. So that's a very good medication in that sense. But two medications which we use a lot of and is surprising is when you look at insulin and sulfonylureas. Now, both are basically doing one thing. They're just driving up the level of insulin. When you do that, you're not helping out insulin resistance. As a matter of fact, you may be actually making it worse because there's more insulin around. So then that drives more cardiovascular disease. So as you talked about, these cardiovascular outcome trials have really been very advantageous for the treatment of diabetes, because just to treat the blood sugar is clearly not the best answer, because you may, sure, you may get their blood sugar better, but then they're going to die of a heart attack next week. That's not a good thing to do. So now the FDA requires that you take, you know, a lot of patients. We're talking 10 to 12,000 patients. You randomize them to your diabetes drug or to placebo. And just so you know, this also is going to be attached to almost all weight loss drugs in the future as well. They're going to have to do this because you may have a weight loss drug that takes your weight down, but then causes cardiovascular problems. So they do that. And usually within 3 to 5 years, you find the answer that either your drug improves the incidence of cardiovascular death, in other words, lowers it, or makes it worse, or there's no effect. If there's no effect, the FDA is okay with that. If it improves it, they're happy as you can get. If it makes it worse, you can guarantee that's not going to get approved. So the one drug that, two drugs now that have been classes that have been shown that are diabetic drugs to improve cardiovascular outcome is one, the SGLT2 inhibitors, the medications that get you to just pee off 300 calories a day in sugar, which again is just amazing to me. We have that ability. And then the other one is the GLP-1s. Particularly liraglutide has very good data showing that as you improve the blood sugar and this mechanism of using just a normal hormone that comes from the intestines that goes to the pancreas and tells the pancreas, make insulin in response to glucose. Don't make it all the time. Just make it if blood sugar goes high. But then also goes to the brain and tells the brain, hey, stop eating. There's plenty of food around. And obviously patients lose weight on this. That in essence, they actually have a lower cardiovascular risk at the end of 3 to 5 years.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that both of the medications that are associated with weight loss are also associated with cardiovascular risk. And I'm not sure if that's the connection, but I think it's an interesting observation.
To me, it has to be part of the answer.
Yes. So thiazolidinediones, or TZDs, are known to promote weight gain, yet are associated with reduced cardiovascular risk in patients without known heart failure. Is there something different about the weight gain associated with TZDs, and what role do they play in your practice in the management of type 2 diabetes?
You know, there is, and I'll tell you a funny story. So years ago when the TZDs first came out, so this is something like pioglitazone, I had published one of my own first articles on weight management and diabetics, and this was almost 25, 30 years ago. So I, of course, I go look up to see if I can find my own article using my name. And I happened to find another guy named Fujioka who had all these publications on peripheral and central fat. And I'm going, who is this guy? And it wasn't me, obviously, the guy in Japan. And what he showed with TZD, so again, it's not me, Ken Fujioka, it's another Fujioka in Japan, but he very beautifully showed with the very first MRIs that were at the time revolutionary, that you literally, when you take a TZD or pioglitazone, you're moving, he called it transferring, but you're changing the genetics of somebody so that their fat is not central, but moves peripherally. So as you mentioned, the weight actually can go up because they gain peripheral fat and edema. But the reality is they're moving the fat from the visceral area to the peripheral area in a very simplistic way. And so you lower that insulin resistance and their blood sugar gets better. And it obviously cardiovascular outcomes are improved.
So similar to what we were talking about before, that shift then from visceral fat to subcutaneous fat moves that weight from an area that might be contributing to the diabetes to an area that may not contribute, if not be potentially even protective.
That's so true. People don't realize there is good fat, and peripheral fat, you can put sugar in there, you can put free fatty acids in there, and it doesn't, you know, you can store it there. It's not flying in and out and creating problems, whereas visceral fat turns over much more quicker, and it's the one that's releasing all the free fatty acids that cause fatty liver disease and cause the insulin resistance. Because you got to remember that all your cells that need glucose or need fat or need energy, they're looking at the blood saying, okay, well, there's glucose and there's fat, and which one am I going to take? But if there's a lot of free fatty acids from the central adiposity, it'll just take the fat. And insulin is also, we always think of it as pushing glucose into cells, but actually insulin loves to push fat into cells as well. So in essence, if it has a choice and there's a lot of free fatty acid around, it'll grab the fat and insulin will direct that. So again, insulin resistance, getting the insulin levels down is a good thing.
I sometimes think of subcutaneous fat as a safe haven for excess calories.
Yeah, exactly. It's a safe place to store energy.
Bariatric surgery has shown some very positive results with respect to improvement in type 2 diabetes. What future role do you see for weight loss surgery in the management of type 2 diabetes?
So I'll split that up into right now and future. So right now, it's very clear that using bariatric surgery to help out with weight loss and control of type 2 diabetes is superior to anything we have. It's truly impressive how, one, patients lose weight, but two, how they get just dramatic improvement in their type 2 diabetes. And if you look at the end of, say, 5 years, their diabetes will be better controlled and they'll be on less meds. With that said, if you look at the medical side of just doing intensive medical treatment, but again, with the idea of treating weight first, in other words, being aggressive with weight management, using our newer medications that we talked about earlier, you can actually get a handful of patients, you know, again, 20-30% that will do just as well as surgery. Now, admittedly, that's a smaller percentage, but we're getting there. Now, if we fast forward to the future, they're going to be pretty close, in my opinion. And clearly, in about 5 years, you're going to see, and a lot of this within one or two, but the newer medications that are coming out for type 2 diabetes, but also for weight management, are just so impressive that they're giving this 17, 18, 20% weight loss that this now rivals bariatric surgery. So the future is so bright to be in this field. I mean, I kind of wish I was a younger man and just starting out, because there's so many new tools that are going to come out that are really going to be powerful to help with weight, to help with diabetes simultaneously, that again, it's a good time to be in the field.
Yes, it is a very exciting time, and that is a message that I relay to the medical students that I teach and the residents that I teach, that there's going to be tremendous opportunities coming forward with the treatment of both obesity and diabetes. So I wanted to ask with one final question, what is your favorite bit of advice to healthcare providers who treat patients with obesity?
Oh, okay. I guess my best advice to somebody who's treating the type 2 diabetic who's struggling with their weight is to treat both. Never let it slip from your mind that you're still dealing with somebody who has a weight issue but still has type 2 diabetes. And so one is, I like all the meds that do treat both, metformin, SGLT2 inhibitors, GLP-1s. But at the same time, you really got to deal with the weight and you got to really think about diet and exercise. And I know it sounds corny because we always hear this, but we talked about this earlier in this podcast that the newer diets are really quite good and safe, and don't be afraid to try them. You're just trying to find something that the patient thinks they can do. And if they say, yeah, I want to do, you know, time-restricted eating, intermittent fasting, let them. It just, as long as you keep an eye on them, they're going to do fine. And then somehow you got to get exercise in there, which is, we did a survey of what do the overweight type 2 diabetics see as their biggest problem? And they all say it's exercise. I'm just not doing it. So find something that they can do and hopefully sustain it as they go forward. But again, keep both in mind, and I think you'll do fine.
And I think it is very important. In obesity medicine, we need to treat the whole patient and every aspect of their life, and not just their sugar and not just their weight, but really treating that whole patient. Well, thank you very much for being with us today. I really enjoyed this conversation and look forward to talking to you again at future conferences.
Thanks for having me on.
Thank you, Dr. Pennings and Fujioka. For more information about obesity medicine podcasts and other resources from the clinical leader in obesity medicine, please visit obesitymedicine.org/podcasts. Love this episode of Obesity, a Disease? Head over to iTunes to subscribe, rate, and leave a review. The views expressed in this podcast episode are those of the show host and do not necessarily represent the opinions, beliefs, or policies of the Obesity Medicine Association or its members. Please check back soon for another episode of Obesity, a Disease.